Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we continue with KTWH volunteer Beth Alexander's reading of Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach's book, A River Through Two Harbors. This book chronicles fictional North Shore law enforcement officer Deidre Johnson, who uncovers a crime ring that is trafficking Native girls to the harbor in Duluth. This book contains mature themes and may not be appropriate for all listeners. We pick up where Beth left off last time.
Deidre was beginning to sense a pattern developing. "Well, I think friends make us happy, and your daddy's my friend. So yes, he does make me happy." She paused a moment, then playfully wrestled with the girls. "But not as happy as you imps do." The girls giggled and tried to tickle Deidre. By 8 o'clock, everyone was dressed. Breakfast had been served, and the holiday was about to get started. Ben had ordered a complete dinner from a supermarket nearby, and at mid-morning he picked up all of the fixings. Thanksgiving Day was snowy. Deidre was sitting at the kitchen table, coffee cup in hand, and looking out the window when the twins peeked around the doorway at her. Sleep was still in their eyes, and their hair stood out from an accumulation of static electricity. They came running to her. "Do you feel better today?" Megan wanted to know. "We don't want you to be sad, Deidre," Marin chimed in. She got down to their level and hugged them. "You girls make me happy. So happy I could just eat you up." And Deidre pretended to nibble on their ears. They squealed in delight. "What about Daddy?" Megan asked. "Does he make you happy?" Deidre was beginning to sense a pattern developing. "Well, I think friends make us happy, and your daddy's my friend. So yes, he does make me happy." She paused a moment, then playfully wrestled with the girls. "But not as happy as you imps do." The girls giggled and tried to tickle Deidre. By 8 o'clock, everyone was dressed. Breakfast had been served, and the holiday was about to get started. Ben had ordered a complete dinner from a supermarket nearby, and at mid-morning he picked up all of the fixings. It was complete with roast turkey, mashed potatoes and gravy, dressing, everything. His brother Cal and his wife Vicky arrived shortly after he returned from the store, and introductions were made. A few minutes later, Ben's sister Stephanie and her husband Bill rang the bell and entered without waiting to be invited. They were followed by their two young pouting preteen kids. With the exception of those two, Deidre was warmly accepted. Ben's parents arrived a half hour late because of the heavy snowfall. That mattered little because all they had to do was heat the meal in the oven or the microwave and serve it. The table had been set hours ago, and there was not much to do except visit and eat. Deidre answered the door, and Ben's mother looked quite surprised to see Deidre there. Evidently, Ben had forgotten to tell his parents that a guest would be joining them. "Deidre," his mother said, and the eaves of the house were not the only thing with icicles hanging from them. "Hello, Mrs. Van Gotten, or can I call you Rebecca?" Deidre cordially asked. "Either way is fine," the older woman answered in a non-inviting way. Ben's father extended his hand. "Hi, Deidre. Jim is fine for me. It's good to see you again. Ben didn't tell us you'd be joining us. Did you drive through the storm to get here this morning?" Before Deidre could answer, Marin piped up. "Oh no, she stayed here last night." Rebecca's left eyebrow almost reached her hairline. She glared at Ben. He said, "Good to see you, Mother. Here, let me take your coat. In fact, there's something I want to show you in the other room." He took his mother's arm in his hand and led her away, leaving Jim and Deidre standing awkwardly in the entry. "Hey, how are my two favorite girls?" Jim called to the twins, warming the room with his exuberance. He pulled two small wrapped gifts from the pocket of his overcoat. "I've got these for you. Let's sit over here on the couch and you can open them." The girls clambered onto the sofa, one on each side of Jim, while Deidre went to the kitchen and busied herself, although nothing needed attention at the time. "Deidre, look what Grandpa brought us," she heard them call to her from the living room. She decided she couldn't hide in the kitchen all day and went to see the girls' gifts. "Isn't this pretty?" Marin asked, lifting her chin so Deidre could see the gold chain necklace and the tiny charm hanging from it. Deidre squatted so she could get closer for a better view. It was an angel, its eyes cast down as though looking from above at something. Megan had an identical necklace. "Grandpa says this is to remind us that we have an angel looking out for us. Do you think that's true, Deidre?" Deidre had no religious upbringing during her childhood, and she had seldom darkened the door of a church. "You listen to what your grandpa says. He must be right." At least she hoped he was. Rebecca and Ben entered from the other room, she daubing her eyes. Ben had a stern look on his face. "I think it's time for us to break out the hors d'oeuvres, don't you, Mother? I'll help with the wine, and we can visit for a while before the meal. Deirdre, will you give me a hand in the kitchen?" They were only gone a few minutes and returned with Deirdre carrying a plate of fancy deli appetizers and Ben carrying a tray of wine glasses for everyone. The twins got sparkling grape juice, and the adults, either red or white wine. When everyone's glass was full, Ben raised his to make a toast. "Here's to family and friend, to my lovely daughters, and to the memory of their mother. Here's to the future. May it be full of good times spent together, peace, and to a blessed year for all of us." "Hear, hear," Jim echoed, and they all took a sip from their glasses. Deirdre had tears in her eyes, as did everyone except the girls, who felt grown up to be included in an actual toast. The meal was served, and, as was to be expected, everyone ate too much, groaning when the pumpkin pie was served and complaining they couldn't eat another bite. But they did. As the adults savored a last cup of coffee before giving up, Rebecca tried her best to make small talk. "I don't know when the last time was I saw you, Deirdre. Perhaps it was when you and Ben were running against each other for sheriff." Out of the corner of her eye, Deirdre saw Ben signal to his mother to stop. The woman had begun to dig herself a hole, but she didn't know how to stop. "Of course, after you won the election, Ben talked about you several times. Everything good, mind you." Deirdre laughed. She remembered the rocky relationship she and Ben had when they were in high school together, and when they had attended the law enforcement academy together, and especially when she was his boss. That was ancient history now, and she was enjoying seeing Ben trying to corral his mother's tongue. Deirdre offered, "Neither Ben nor I are the same persons we were then, Rebecca. I'd trust my life to your son. He's a true gentleman, a wonderful father, and a great person. I think both of us would like to forget the past. Don't you think that would be best?" Ben's brother Cal tried to calm the waters. "Of course we all change. Don't you remember when you tried to stop me from seeing Vicky? And look how you love her now." He winced when Vicky stepped on his foot under the table. "But that's in the past, so let's enjoy the day and being together." He thought he better shut up. Rebecca shifted uneasily in her chair. "Of course, dear, it's a little awkward for me. Jenny hasn't been gone very long, and Ben's so vulnerable right now. I worry about him and the girls." She swallowed hard. Deirdre understood vulnerable. "Rebecca, believe me, I'm not taking advantage of your son or his situation. We're just very good friends. I love your granddaughters more than you can imagine. Someday, I hope Ben finds someone who can be their mother. But for now, I'm trying to help out." "And doing a wonderful job," Ben interjected. "Mom, let it rest now." Jim changed the subject, asking Ben if he had been ice fishing yet. Stephanie asked Deirdre where she was working, and the talk became more relaxed. At the end of the day, Ben's parents, his siblings, and their families said goodbye. His mother gave Deirdre a cursory hug, but whispered in her ear, "Thank you for being kind to my granddaughters." She turned and walked out the door ahead of her husband. When they left, Ben said, "Well, that went well, don't you think?" He laughed, and Deirdre never asked what was said between him and his mother in the other room. By Sunday afternoon, Deirdre had to begin thinking about returning to Two Harbors and her job. She was ready to get on with the investigation, but it was difficult leaving. Chapter 17. "Morning, boss lady," Jill greeted Deirdre. Her voice lacked its usual upbeat tone, and her face made Deirdre think the weekend had not gone well. "How'd Thanksgiving work out for you?" Deirdre asked, thinking she might gain some insight into her secretary. "Like any other weekend, I suppose. I did a lot of reading and spent time with my two cats. They miss me when I'm at work. Other than that, I volunteered at the women's shelter so the staff could spend time with their families. Not a happy place to be on a holiday." Deirdre didn't push the issue. "I suppose not. Anyway, are you ready to get to work? I've got some things I need done as soon as possible." Jill nodded. "First, make an appointment for me to see that attorney, Gerald Coulter, this morning. The earlier the better. Second, I want to set up a meeting in Thunder Bay with Henry Muzio and Charles Freeman. Then I'll drive up this afternoon if they can see me on such short notice. Contact Sheriff D'Angelo and see if he's available to meet with me when I return from Mr. Coulter's office." Deirdre paused to let her finish taking notes. "When you get those meetings set up, will you please call the hospital in Duluth? Request the name of the physician who'll be treating the abuse victim we rescued. When you obtain that info, had the BCA director request a copy of the girl's medical records be made available to me for my investigation. Jill perked up with the knowledge she would be busy. Deidre retreated to her desk and the computer. She had just begun to run Jason Leader's fingerprints through the national database when Jill placed a note on her desk. You are set to meet Gerald Coulter at 8:30 this morning. Good luck. Deidre smiled. In their crowded office, Jill could have spoken across the room. The girl was a hard one to figure out. She looked at her watch. 8:10. Gotta go. I think I'll be back within an hour. If not, call the police. She laughed and saw Jill grin back. It was only a few minutes' ride to Coulter's law office, and Deidre arrived 5 minutes early. The receptionist at the outer desk asked her to have a seat, saying that Mr. Coulter would be with her as quickly as he could manage. Deidre picked up a copy of the Duluth newspaper and sat down opposite the young lady. She peered over the top of the paper as she held it in front of her face. I'd expect his receptionist to look like this. Wonder if they are real or fake. She hardly looks 18. In her mind, she continued to make observations until she ran out of critical thoughts. As she waited, her mind wandered back to when she was sheriff of Lake County and when a public meeting was held after the Seven Graves incident. Her teeth involuntarily ground together. After she and her partner had picked up his son, Gerald Coulter III, on suspicion of drug abuse, Coulter, the attorney, made life miserable for her, humiliating her at the meeting, organizing a recall election, and literally forcing her from office. Deidre took a deep breath, shifted in her chair, casually glanced over the front page headlines, and turned to the comic section. She checked her watch. 8:52, nearly a half hour late. Finally, the receptionist announced, Mr. Coulter will see you now. She got up from her desk and opened the door to his private office. Gerald Coulter rose from his chair, a forced smile on his face. Deidre Johnson, how pleasant to begin my day by meeting with you. Deidre wanted to punch him. She smiled back, as best she could. What's this I hear that you're employed by the BCA? That's quite a step up from Sheriff of Lake County. I suppose there must be a reason for your promotion. Deidre was becoming more annoyed. And that reason is why I'm calling on you, Mr. Coulter, she snapped. There's no reason we can't be civil. I was only making small talk, but then, if I remember correctly, you always were a little defensive. So what is it that you want from me? Deidre sat down without being invited. The attorney took the cue and took a chair diagonal to hers. I want information about one of your former clients, she began. And who might that be? He asked in his usual patronizing manner. Jason Leader. Do you recognize the name? Leader. He rolled the name off his tongue as though he were trying to conjure up an image of the client. Finally, he shook his head. No, I can't say I do. Of course, I'd have a file on him if I ever did represent him. Deidre was so exasperated that she began to curse, but caught herself, nearly biting her tongue. You represented him in 4 cases involving alleged sexual infractions, ranging from prostitution to a possible sexual encounter with a juvenile. Does that help your memory? Again, Coulter appeared to be racking his brain for an answer. After several seconds, his brow furrowed, and he said, I'm sorry, I just can't place the man's name. Deidre pressed on. Last week, Judge Tony DeMarcus was arrested in a prostitution sting in Edina. Now do you recall anything? With the mention of Judge DeMarcus's name, Coulter blanched. I did read about that in the paper, but what does this have to do with me? I'm only a small-town attorney. Most of my cases would be considered penny ante by big-time lawyers. Deidre knew she was beginning to strike a nerve and smiled at the man. What it has to do with you, Mr. Coulter, is that the records show you represented Jason Leader 4 times in a 4th District courtroom, and in each case, Judge DeMarcus presided. Not only that, in each case, Mr. Leader got off almost totally free. You might be interested to know that last week, the day after he was arrested, I spoke with the judge at his home. Coulter squirmed in his chair and ran his fingers through his hair. Did you get your information about this man, Leader, from the judge? Deidre noticed beads of sweat were beginning to form on his brow. I'll be honest with you, Gerald, she said, using his familiar name to further show she was in control. Your name didn't come up during our conversation. What I told you is in the public record. Visibly, Coulter exhaled the breath he had been holding and relaxed somewhat. Deidre didn't want to let him off the hook that easily. We've established that you represented Jason Leader 4 times in cases involving sex offenses. We also have a connection between you and Judge DeMarcus, If only that he heard your arguments, although most people would question the fact that in all four cases, the defendant got no real punishment. She could see Coulter's fingers clenching the armrests on his chair. Which gets me to the point of my visit. I want to know what your relationship was to Jason Leader. You should know that information is protected by attorney-client privilege. I can't divulge what was said between us or why I was hired for his case. Deidre pounced on the crack in his statement. Oh, so now he's your client. Funny how quickly your memory repaired itself. Is there anything else you want to tell me about him? Gerald Coulter's eyes narrowed to slits, and he spit his words out. I'm required by law to hold any information relative to our conversations in strict confidence. Yes, he was my client. And yes, DeMarcus was the judge each time. I had no control over that. Is there anything else? Yes, Jason Leader died in a struggle on Palisade Head. Would you like to know what the struggle was about? She didn't give him time to answer. He was assaulting a girl who doesn't appear to be much more than 14 years old. Your client's dead. Now, is there anything you want to tell me? The oily smile reappeared on the attorney's face. I know you law enforcement people are not well versed in the legal aspect of the law. Let me fill you in. In 1998, the Supreme Court heard a case, Swindler and Berlin versus United States. Perhaps you've heard of it? Kenneth Starr, I'm sure you recognize that name, subpoenaed notes taken during a meeting between Vince Foster and his attorney. 9 days after the meeting, Mr. Foster committed suicide. Mr. Starr wanted the notes to be admitted as evidence in his investigation, saying there was precedence to negate the attorney-client privilege in certain cases. The argument went all the way to the Supreme Court, which ruled in favor of the plaintiff. So you see, Ms. Johnson, the attorney-client privilege extends beyond the death of the client. Coulter began to stand. I think our meeting has come to a conclusion, don't you? However, Deidre interjected, in the court's opinion, if the attorney claims client privilege to support his own interest, the privilege is revoked. Or, as in another scenario, if the client's conversation with his attorney may be key in preventing another crime, that can also negate the privilege. Coulter sat. If that's the way you want it, go ahead. But be careful. You may be way over your head, detective, or whatever you are. At any rate, Gerald, I think you're right. Our meeting is probably over. She watched him begin to get up. Don't bother, Coulter. I can find my way out. None too gently, she closed his door behind her, smiled at the receptionist, and walked out of the building. She pictured Gerald Coulter II sitting in his chair, wondering what this was eventually going to mean for him. Back at the office, she noticed Jill seemed in better spirits. Evidently, having something to accomplish took her mind off whatever had been bothering her. Did you get any results from the hospital? Deidre queried as she took a seat at her desk. Jill spun to face her, a paper in hand. I got through to the hospital. They were able to give me the name of the pediatrician and the psychiatrist treating our little Jane Doe. She handed the sheet of paper to Deidre. On it were two names, along with phone numbers. Dr. Jan Bilka, Pediatric Medicine, 555-1422. Dr. William Salenka, Psychiatry, 555-3673. Each doctor wants to visit with you in person. They sounded disturbed about what they've observed as far as the girl's condition and seemed willing to cooperate with you as best they can. I told them you were busy for the remainder of the day, but I set up appointments with them tomorrow morning. Grand Chief Muzio is expecting you at 3 this afternoon in Thunder Bay. Charles Freeman will be there as well. Is that okay? Jill, I'm beginning to wonder how I'd manage without your help. Deidre was truly beginning to appreciate what her receptionist was able to do. Thanks, boss lady, Jill mumbled as she turned back to what she was doing at her desk. Deidre looked at her watch and sighed. I'd better be out of here if I'm going to make it to Thunder Bay by 3. While I'm gone, will you research what's happened to Judge DeMarcus since his arrest? It's been nearly 2 weeks, and I haven't read anything about him in the newspaper. I hope this isn't a matter of the good old boys club sweeping their sins under the carpet. See you tomorrow. Bye, boss lady. The road to Thunder Bay was becoming too familiar, and Deidre was lost in thought, her vehicle on automatic pilot. Suddenly, a deer, a doe, leapt across the road only 50 yards ahead of her. Deidre's reaction time was a little slow, and she had hardly stomped on the brake pedal when a buck, chasing the doe, shot out of the ditch. It was toward the end of their mating season, but that hadn't dampened the buck's hormones, and he was oblivious to everything but the scent of the doe. During the 2 seconds between when the doe crossed the highway and when the buck emerged from the ditch, Deirdre's vehicle covered nearly 50 yards, and the buck's form was broadside to her path. She could feel the automatic braking system of her SUV pulsating, and she nearly pushed her free foot through the floorboard. At the last instant, the deer gave a desperate lunge, and through her driver's side window, she saw the white flag of his tail. She continued on for another quarter mile and then pulled over to the side of the road. Deirdre's legs felt as though they were made of jello, and her hands were shaking. She realized how close she had come to hitting a 250-pound deer and perhaps killing herself. She pulled back onto the road, this time not using her cruise control, and vowing to be more vigilant. She crossed through customs with no incident, and at 2:45 pulled into the usual parking ramp in downtown Thunder Bay. "Deirdre," the chief greeted her, shaking her hand. "It's good to see you again. Have a seat. Can I get you anything? Coffee? A soda?" He pointed to the other person in the room. "You remember Charles, our chief of police." Deirdre thanked Henry for his offer of a beverage, but declined. "Charles, I'm glad you could see me on such short notice. I'm sorry to tell you I need your help again. It's almost the same scenario as the last time, but this time the victim is alive, barely." The men glanced at each other, and Henry said, "We know you want to see us for that reason. Your secretary wouldn't reveal much to us, stating that there was a confidentiality issue with her giving out too much information. She said you would rather turn it over to us in person. She seems to be on top of things." Deirdre just smiled and nodded. "We know you are very busy on the last case we discussed and that you need to get back tonight, so let's not waste your time with chatter. How can we help you?" Deirdre went into detail about following tracks to the top of Palisade Head, sparing none of the details of the ensuing struggle. She explained what had happened to the girl she and Jeff rescued, but never referred to her as Jane Doe. The girl deserved more respect than that, she thought. The two tribal leaders listened intently, bowing their heads in disgust at times. "The real reason I've come here in person is that we have an idea of the man who is trying to throw her off the cliff. His name is Jason Leader, and his address is listed as Thunder Bay." Both men shook their heads. "The name doesn't ring a bell," Charles admitted. Henry agreed. "Of course, this is a big city, and the outlying area is heavily populated for a 10-mile radius. Jason hasn't been an angel while in the States. He has quite a record following him." "Then why hasn't he been deported?" Henry wanted to know. "That's where the waters become muddy. He's been brought up on charges 4 times, appearing before the same judge each time. Every time he's been released for one reason or another. He has no convictions against him. We've found through court records that the same attorney from Two Harbors represented him. Can you access Leader's record while I'm here? I've brought copies of his fingerprints and samples of his DNA, if that will be of help. I also have fingerprints of the girl and samples of her DNA." The chief looked over at Charles. "That's your area. Can we place a rush on this so Deirdre might have some answers today?" The head of the Nan Police Force shrugged. "We can surely try. Naturally, the DNA will take longer. We also have a photo file of missing people. It's computerized, so we can narrow it down by characteristics. My office is 2 floors down. Let's go there and get started. Maybe you can be on the road by early evening." Henry Musio did not accompany the police chief and Deirdre, and as the two walked to the elevator, he expressed what Deirdre had been thinking. "Do you believe the dead girl and the girl in the hospital are separate cases, or do you think they're connected?" She thought a moment. "I don't know. It certainly appears they're connected. On the other hand, I don't want to go with any preconceived notions. Are there any ways your laws concerning attorney-client privilege differ from ours so that you can apply pressure to Gerald Coulter, the attorney I spoke of in the chief's office?" Charles shook his head. "I'm afraid not. Our laws and yours concerning that issue are about the same, even when it pertains to a deceased client. He seems pretty protected at the present." By that time, they were at the floor which housed the investigative offices of his force. He strode to the desk of one of his people. "We need a rush on this set of prints. I'd appreciate your dropping what you're doing and see if you can find a match. It's terribly important." They walked further into the room and stopped at another desk. Without introducing Deirdre, he asked for the DNA samples she had brought and handed it to a technician. "Run a profile on this as soon as possible. See if we can come up with a match. I know it'll take a while, but what's your estimated timetable?" The technician calculated it would be at least a week before they could have anything. "Let's go back to my office and wait for the print results. I have a computer we can use. I'm able to access a file we have on missing persons. Maybe we'll get lucky." The chief booted up the PC on his desk. I've accessed our missing persons file. Now we have to begin winnowing out the chaff. Female. And Deirdre heard the click of a key as the chief clicked on that subject. That got rid of a few. Still leaves us with over 600 possible choices. How old do you think the girl is? About 14 at the most. Let's try 10 to 15 then. She saw his hand move and heard the click. That narrows the field to 310. From this group, I can select specific ages. I'll try 14. Again, his hand moved, followed by a click. Now we're down to 96. He turned the monitor so they both could see it. You can advance the photos one at a time using the mouse. Spend as much time on each picture as you need. If nothing rings a bell in this group, we'll try another. Deirdre began working her way through the file. In most cases, she could eliminate the subject at a glance. Some were way too heavy, some too thin. Others had faces marred with acne. Still others had features that didn't match. It took her half an hour to finish the file. Sorry, Chief, none of them matched our girl. The chief took the mouse, canceled out of the file, and brought up those missing girls who were 13. Deirdre began another search, beginning to grow weary. She clicked the mouse. This is the one, she almost shrieked. That's her. The chief of police sat stoically staring at the screen. How can you be so certain? He asked in a non-confrontational tone. Everything fits, the shape of her mouth, her nose, her ears, even her hairline. But what makes me so certain are her eyebrows. She's so traumatized that she hardly blinks and stares straight ahead. Her eyes have a spooky look to them, but her eyebrows arch upward, giving her an exotic look. Look at the eyebrows of the girl in this picture. That's her, I'm sure of it. Charles double-clicked on the picture and another file opened. This had a smaller picture of the girl in the upper right-hand corner. The remainder of the screen was filled with data. Name, Kimmy Thomas. Mother, Alicia Thomas. Birth date, August 6, 2000. Father, unknown. Date missing, June 25, 2013. Next of kin, Sally Cloud, aunt. Identifying marks, 2-inch crescent scar on right hip, evidence of broken medial malleolus of the left tibia, evidence of an appendectomy. Notes, Kimmy Thomas disappeared on June 25, 2013, but was not reported missing until 2 weeks later. Her aunt filed the report. The whereabouts of her mother, Alicia Thomas, is unknown. I'm afraid this is something we run into too often. The girls who disappear often had tough times at home and are on the streets to avoid the unpleasantness of their domestic situations. They're easy prey. Someone knocked on his door, and Charles called for him to come in. The person requested to look up Jason's record handed Charles a sheet of paper. Charles scanned it for a few seconds.
You've been listening to episode 9 of A River Through Two Harbors by Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach. There will be a total of 20 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in next time for more from A River Through Two Harbors. If you miss an episode, you can find it on our website, ktwh.org, by clicking on Programs and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each weekend, we'll post the episodes for you to catch up on. To learn more about human trafficking in Minnesota, go to www.yourcallmn.org. Please join us again next time for A River Through Two Harbors here on Literally from the North Shore.